I sit with Petra and Diana, and Isabel brings over tumblers and Irish whiskey. I don't think Val was Irish, I say. Do you have any idea what her heritage was? I shake my head. Then in the interests of a proper wake, tonight she was Irish, and we are playing poker. Never been to an actual wake, have you? Petra says. I'm improvising. Otherwise we'll sit here and try to come up with things to say about the dearly departed, and it will get very awkward very fast. Isabel pours the whiskey. Have any of you ever attended one of those funerals, where it's very clear that no one actually has anything interesting to say about the deceased? Or anything nice, Diana says as she takes her drink. The lack of anything nice would be far worse than the lack of anything interesting. That's what I want for my funeral. I don't give a damn if anyone tells a single story that reflects well on me. Just tell stories. Val liked tea, I say. Diana snickers and then sobers with, sorry. The point being, Isabel says, that we have not a single interesting thing to say about Val. We didn't know her, I say. Not for lack of trying. Shortly after she arrived, she got lost in the forest and was attacked. Isabel nods. I know. She came to you? Val asked for help? Never. But I have counseled enough survivors to know she did not wander out of that forest unscathed. I tried to broach the subject once, to offer support, and she shut me down. Nothing happened, and I should go practice my mediocre skills on real victims. She raises her glass to me. Kudos on being the one to break through. I didn't. When I confronted her, she said that to have allowed herself to be attacked would have been a sign of weakness. Strong women don't do that. Ouch, Petra says. An unfortunately common belief, Isabel says. Also monumentally wrong and stupid, but that goes without saying. We take a drink. Val, however, was not a stupid woman, Isabel says. She'd been a mathematician. I didn't know that, I say. I'd seen her doing math puzzles, not the kind you get in a paperback book, but real puzzles, theoretical ones. Even if she didn't open up to you about the attack, Casey, you were the one to break through, to get her out of that house and into the community. Yep, I take a slug of my whiskey, and look where it got her. Three mouths open in simultaneous denials. I beat them to it with, this morning, Phil said Val made a mistake trying to join life in Rockton, that her place was separate and apart from us. He may have had a point. Phil is an idiot. Gorgeous, but an idiot. And I don't just say that because he looked at me like I was a bag lady blocking the steps to his brownstone. It wasn't that bad, I say. Oh, yes, it was. But since he wasn't checking you out either, I won't take it personally. You both might be the wrong gender, Petra says. He didn't give Will more than a passing glance. The sneer wasn't a physical assessment, I say. It was disdain for everyone and everything here. But I still wonder if he was right about Val. We couldn't afford to lose our leader, and involving herself in our affairs endangered her. Well, if that's your reasoning, you'd better tell Eric he has to stay in the station from now on. He's the one we can't afford to lose. Val was... Isabel swirls her drink and shakes her head. This isn't the proper way to conduct a wake, is it? Does anyone have anything nice to say? Diana says. She liked tea, Petra quips. Then she adds, the truth is that none of us knew her well enough to eulogize her. But a year ago, no one would have been holding a wake for her either. She was coming out of her shell. She was starting to care. We were starting to care back. Isabel raises her glass. Then let's drink to that. A woman we didn't always understand, a woman we didn't always like, but a woman we were looking forward to getting to know better. A missed and mourned opportunity. We clink glasses. Now, poker? Petra says. For credits, I hope, because I will clean you all out. The door opens and Isabel calls, Closed! Dalton walks in.
Got a situation, Casey. I need you.
I'm getting to my feet when Diana says, Can't you handle it alone, Sheriff? Casey deserves a rest. So does he, I say, and he hasn't been sitting here drinking whiskey. She opens her mouth, but a murmur from Isabel stops her. A quiet reminder, I'm sure, that harping on Dalton does nothing to bring Diana back into my good graces. When we get outside, I say, We were attempting to eulogize Val. It wasn't going well. He slows.
Shit. I'm sorry. If you want to go back.
The eulogy part was over. It was booze and cards henceforth. Somehow, I don't think Val would have approved. He takes my hand as we walk. I might joke, but he knows that week wasn't easy. Any reminder of Val is a reminder of how she died. But Isabel is right. Val deserved a few quiet moments of our time. So what's up? I say.
Kenny's missing.
What?
He was out searching with a party. I wanted him at the lumber shed to deal with the reconstruction issues. When it was definitely dark, he points at the night sky. I went to see why he wasn't back yet.
And?
His group returned 15 minutes earlier. He had to use the bathroom. Someone stood outside waiting, not wanting to rush him.
Let me guess. He's not in the bathroom.
Yep.
Chapter 44. There are three levels of occupancy here in Rockton. At the top is having your own house. At the bottom is apartment living, bachelor-style apartments. In the middle, you get the full level of a house, which still only nets you about 600 square feet. Yes, we aren't exactly living in mansions here. We can't afford the energy costs or the footprint. Kenny has a ground floor, which means it was very easy to sneak out the window while his guard was watching at the front. And his guard? Jen.
Which is why you should have put a guy in charge of him, she says. Someone who can stand in the bathroom while he takes a shit.
Yeah, not even the guys are gonna do that,
Dalton says.
But next time someone's in there that long, knock. Ask if he needs medical care.
He took a book. I knew it was gonna be a while. A book from the library? I say.
Everyone does it.
Which is why I don't read books from the library, Dalton says.
He stands in the bathroom and looks at the window.
Fuck.
Eloquent as always, Sheriff, Jen says.
Yeah, well, I'm saving time on a lengthy response.
He strides for the door.
Time better spent catching his ass before he rendezvous with Oliver Brady and gets his full throat cut.
I join the search for a while with Storm. The problem? Kenny knows what Storm can and cannot do, which means he runs straight to the nearest stream. We lead Storm up one side of it for about a kilometer, as far as we figure he could walk in the icy water. Then we take her down the other side and another kilometer in the opposite direction. Either Kenny managed to steal waterproof boots and three pairs of wool socks, or Storm misses his exit spot. Dalton takes her on a wider circle in the area while I return to town. There are a few things I want to check, and with both Dalton and Storm hunting, I really am a third wheel. I want to look for a note. Even with what seems like an obvious betrayal, I still can't write Kenny off just yet. I find it much easier to believe he was duped by Brady's protests of innocence rather than jumping at a huge bribe to help a serial killer. If so? If so, I have an alternate theory for his disappearance. One that paints Kenny in a better light. One that fits better with the man I know. I find the note in the station. Paul said Kenny came in here earlier to return a flashlight that he claimed belonged to me. I find the note in the drawer, along with a spare flashlight. The note is addressed to me. And when I read it, I discover I was wrong. Very, very wrong. Dalton comes home at 3 in the morning. From the kitchen, I hear the door open,
the solid boom-boom of his boots stepping inside, and then the skitter and scrape of Storm's nails as she zips past him. After that double boom, his footsteps go silent. He's looking for me in the living room. When he doesn't see me, there's a sigh, and his boots come off, thumping to the floor. Steps move into the living room. Not the solid boom of his initial ones. Not even his usual purposeful stride. These are dragging and whispery, socks skimming the hard wood. Then the thud of him collapsing onto the sofa. He doesn't hear me come out of the kitchen, and I catch that first unguarded glimpse of him. Forearms on his thighs, shoulders bowed, gaze empty as he stares at nothing. The floorboard creaks with my next step, and he looks over, and his face lights in a smile. I know he thought I'd gone to bed, and while he'd never complain about that, yes, he was disappointed. Now he sees me and smiles. Then he gets a whiff of the dinner I'm carrying, and his gaze goes to it. "Don't worry, I didn't cook it," I say. "Isabel wouldn't let me." He shakes his head. I take the plates of rewarmed dinner onto the back deck, and we eat in silence. I wait until he finishes before I say, "Kenny left a note." Dalton's head jerks up at that. Then he snorts and says,
"What? Telling us we were fucking idiots for not keeping a closer eye on him?"
Which isn't what he expects at all. He's just bracing for the worst. This was a person Dalton trusted. He feels betrayed, and so he wants to believe Kenny was not the man he thought. It makes this easier than any of the alternatives.
"Tell me he betrayed us, that he deserves whatever happens to him in that forest."
I hand him the note. As he reads it, I watch him, his cheek twitching, gaze skimming the first time through, and then slowing to reread. When he finishes, he crushes the paper and whips it across the back lawn.
"God fucking damn it, no,"
he snarls, pushing to his feet.
"Is he an idiot?" "Yes, obviously, he fucking is. The biggest goddamn idiot."
Dalton can't even seem to continue, and he starts pacing instead. Storm scratches at the back door. I've left her inside, and I know she's hurt and confused, certain we've accidentally forgotten her, patiently waiting for us to realize our mistake. Now she hears Dalton curse, and she scratches, a tentative whine seeping through the wooden door. Dalton wheels on me.
"This is what I need. Exactly what we both need, because clearly we're not doing fuck all here. Hey, why don't I just take off into the goddamn forest and give you guys something to do? Or maybe no, we won't chase him because we don't give a shit. That's why he had to take off. Catch this murdering asshole himself. Because we aren't trying. So he'll do it for us and prove he wasn't Brady's accomplice, because otherwise we'll just punish him and not bother with a fucking investigation."
I let Dalton rant, let him express my own frustration and my fear and my rage. I still recall every word of that note. "Casey, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to find Brady and bring him back for you. It's my fault he escaped and killed Val and your friend and those settlers. I didn't help him. I swear I didn't, but I'm going to bring him back. I'll catch him, and he can tell you who was his real accomplice. I'm sorry for all the trouble I've caused. Kenny."
"Trouble he's caused?" Dalton says. "He's sorry for the fucking trouble he caused, so the best way to fix that is to cause more. Poor Kenny feels guilty, blames himself. Fucking awesome. Let's share that blame. Let Jen have some when Kenny dies, for letting him escape. Let you have some for suspecting he was the accomplice. Let me have some for trusting him enough to let him out of that cell. Let's all take another helping of the fucking blame pie, because it's clear we haven't eaten enough of it already."
He spins on me.
"What am I supposed to do here, Casey? I feel like we're spending this whole damn case searching for people. Brady, Val, Jacob, now Kenny. I tell them not to go into the forest. I regulate every damn step out there until I feel like a paranoid parent. But they keep doing it. They walk out of this town and they die. Do I need to build a fucking wall? A barbed wire fence? Post armed guards? Shoot anyone who tries to leave? These are supposed to be responsible adults. But they come here and they act like fucking children. Which means we have to be the fucking parents. No, not children. Teenagers. And we're just obstacles standing between them and whatever shit they want to pull. Well, if that's the way they want it, then fuck yeah, that's what they're getting. Prison guards.
My gaze flicks from Dalton as I notice something to the side. A figure stands just around the rear corner of our house. Watching Dalton rage, listening to him rant, observing and judging. I get to my feet.
Can I help you, Phil?
Dalton spins with a, what the fuck?
I wish to speak to you both,
Phil says as he walks into the yard. It's almost 4 a.m., I say. We're on our own time and our own property. This is a private conversation.
At that volume? No, I don't think it is.
There's more judgment in his voice and I want to snap at him, but I only say, then I'll repeat that we are on our own time. We'll speak to you in the morning. Phil walks over as if I haven't spoken.
I take it you didn't find Kenny?
No, I say as evenly as I can. We will resume the search tomorrow.
I don't think that's necessary.
Excuse me, Dalton says. I understand you suspected him of being Oliver Brady's accomplice.
We did, I say. The evidence fit, but it was all circumstantial. That's why we let Kenny out of the cell on work duty. If you wish to debate that decision, I'll suggest it's unnecessary. We already realize that might not have been wise.
I don't care what choice you made regarding Kenny's incarceration. My point is that the only reason to pursue him is in hopes he'll lead you to Oliver. That is unlikely. Oliver has staff, not partners. He conned this man into helping him, and now he will have abandoned him as unnecessary. Otherwise, Kenny would have fled with him. Correct?
He doesn't even wait for a response before continuing.
Kenny left because he realized his guilt had been uncovered, and it was only a matter of time.
No,
Dalton says. Phil sighs. It's a familiar sigh, one I've heard countless times underscored by the feedback from a radio receiver.
I know you...
He left a note. Dalton points at the wadded paper on the lawn. He blames himself for Brady escaping and wants to bring him back. Kenny accepts responsibility because he left his post, not because he was in cahoots with Brady.
Another sigh. The sort of supercilious teacher gives a student he considers not terribly bright.
Just because Kenny claims, that doesn't mean it's true, Sheriff.
Of course he'll defend himself.
My point is that he isn't your concern. He has made his choice. He might hope to find Oliver, perhaps even kill him, to cover his own crimes. But he's unlikely to succeed. His flight proves his guilt, and therefore, whatever justice the forest meets out...
Phil shrugs.
It saves the council from doing it, Dalton says.
There's a warning note in Dalton's voice, but Phil only says,
yes, it does. Casey no longer needs to waste time proving his guilt, and you can both focus on Oliver instead. Take this as a reprieve. Do not turn it into a cause for extra effort.
A reprieve, Dalton says. Extra effort? Kenny was a valued member of my militia. And whatever you might think of what he's done, he deserves nothing. If you feel guilty, take this as an order. You may not search for this man. If you happen to find him, all right. Do what you must.
Do what I must?
Dalton says, his voice lowering.
Kill him, you mean? Of course not. Bring him back. If I must. Because, you know, the alternative is to just let him die out there. Which is worse than killing him. And it's not like if I bring him back, he's going to live much longer anyway. Maybe I should just kill him.
I see where Dalton's heading, and I try to get his attention and cut him off, but before I can, Phil says,
What are you talking about?
Sure, yeah. Let's pretend you don't know.
Eric, I say. Dalton advances on the other man.
Tell me, Phil. What happens if I bring Kenny back and put him on your plane? What happened to Beth after I dropped her off?
Beth Lowry is fine, and to suggest otherwise only proves you are exhausted and need...
What if I want her back? We need a doctor. Let's bring Beth back for a while.
Can we do that, Phil?
Certainly not. After what she did, forget about bringing her back.
We have medical questions. How about the council hires her for satellite consultations?
We cannot. Do you know where she is, Phil?
I don't care, and neither should you.
But she is alive. We are not executioners.
No?
Then tell me about the deal you tried to make with Tyrone Cipher.
Phil's face screws up.
Who? The sheriff before Gene Dalton.
That is long before my time, as you well know.
The council tracked him down in the forest, tried to cut him a deal. Ty says he knows what it was because he has one real talent. His former occupation. A hitman.
Phil bursts into a laugh.
Is that what he told you?
I'm sure whatever this Cipher man did in his past life, he was not a hired killer.
The council would never put such a man in Rockton.
No? Then tell me about Harry Powis.
Eric, I say sharply.
No, please, Casey, Phil says. It seems the sheriff has a few things to get off his chest.
If you are suggesting Harry Powis was a hired killer, worse, Dalton says. He was a doctor who drugged illegal immigrants and removed their organs. Sometimes they lived, sometimes they didn't. Being in the country illegally, though, it wasn't like they could complain.
Phil stares at him. What Eric means, I begin.
Please, Casey.
There is no alternative interpretation you can come up with to explain that away, however embarrassing I'm sure you find it.
I bristle.
I don't find it. The sheriff's exposure to our culture is limited largely to his books and videos, dime store novels and fantasy television shows.
That's not, and from those, he clearly has a distorted view on the world, one that someone has exploited by feeding him ridiculous stories.
Black market organ sales are the stuff of pulp fiction and urban legend, Sheriff. Whoever told you Harry Powis did such a thing was pulling a prank.
Look it up, Dalton says.
What?
Harrison Powers. That's his real name.
Google it. You'll find news articles, legitimate news articles, about a doctor suspected of exactly what I said.
A warrant was issued for his arrest. He disappeared.
Check the dates. Check the photograph. Compare it to Harry Powis.
Silence. 3 long pulses of it. Then Phil says,
whoever told you they found this online, I found it. I'm not illiterate, you pompous jackass. I can use the fucking internet and read the goddamn evidence, which I verify against alternate sources.
Dalton steps closer to Phil.
You let a man like that into my town. For profit. And he murdered Abigail. They chopped up her body and scattered it for scavengers. That's who you let in here. Because it was profitable.
I'm sorry, Sheriff. I don't know how you came across this information, but it is wrong. Completely and utterly.
Dalton hits him.
A right hook to the jaw. Phil flies off his feet.
Dalton steps away. Then he follows me into the house, leaving Phil on the ground outside. Chapter 45. We're upstairs in our bedroom. Phil is gone. I checked out the balcony window. I've let Storm upstairs, only because it would be more upsetting to keep her out and listen to her cry. Dalton is in the chair by our bed, and she's at his feet, her muzzle on his boots, which he's forgotten to take off. I bend to untie them, and he removes them silently. Then he says,
I fucked up.
Yes. He looks at me.
This is the one time I'm not going to argue, I say. You opened a hornet's nest that we should have left alone. I take his boots and set them outside the door. It was going to happen sooner or later. Probably best that it happened when it's just Phil, without the council listening in. That will make it easier for us to control the damage.
Our word against his?
He makes a face, and I know he hates that. It's underhanded and dishonest. No, I have another idea. But first, I have to ask if you want this damage controlled. Or is this scorched earth time? He exhales and leans forward, both hands running through his hair. Then he shakes his head.
There's part of me that says, fuck yeah. Just throw it all out there and end this. Pack our things and go. But that's me being pissy.
Which you'd regret about 12 hours later.
Yeah. As much as I'd like to confront the council, what good does it do? They'll pull a Phil, pretend they don't know what I'm talking about, treat me like a delusional idiot. Then they'll shut me up, exile me, exile you, or worse. So no, this isn't scorched earth time. This is Casey fixes Eric's fuck-up time. And you have an idea about how to do that?
I do. After Dalton is asleep, I slip over to Anders' place to ask him to take the first search shift this morning. I know he's only been to bed for a couple of hours, and me waking him doesn't help. But when I explain what happened, he offers before I can ask. Then it's back home to make sure the blackout blinds are closed, reset the alarm, and ease into bed. When the alarm sounds at 9 and I admit my subterfuge, Dalton grumbles, until I point out that I would much rather not trick him and just be able to ask him to stay in bed until he's rested enough to search properly. He agrees, even apologizes. Whether he'll voluntarily sleep in when I ask is another matter. I can't say I'm any better, though. Phil is at the station when we arrive. He's waiting by my desk, his arms crossed as if we're tardy children. Dalton sees him and slows to an amble, perversely acting as if he's just strolled in whenever he feels like it. He walks right past Phil and puts on the kettle for coffee. I believe we have an issue to discuss, Phil says.
Yeah, Dalton says as he stokes the fire. I'd like to explain.
Phil's voice chills even more.
I don't think that's possible.
Dalton straightens, still holding the poker.
You were right about Powis.
I should certainly hope.
It's entirely possible the council didn't know what he was. I know that, which is why I've never said anything until I lost my temper last night.
Dalton puts the poker back.
As for whether he did that shit, the answer is yes. Like I said, it's online. I suspected Powis was involved with making the Rydex, especially with his background. According to his entry papers, he was a pharmacist.
Correct.
So I went looking online, and dug up more than I bargained for.
Perhaps, but that hardly proves we let him buy his way in.
Agreed. If you don't know anything about it, then obviously he faked his admission file.
Phil's eyes narrow as if he's waiting for the punchline.
I don't like the council, Dalton says calmly. Never made any secret of that. But yeah, accusing them of that went too far. So I apologize. Good?
No, Eric. It is not good. When I said I wanted an apology, I meant for this. He gestures to the bruise on his jaw.
Fuck no, Dalton says. You deserve that.
Phil's sputtering as the door swings open.
Good, you're still here, Wallace says as he walks in. I was afraid I'd been left behind. So when do we start searching for Oliver?
Dalton does not want to take Wallace into the forest. He argues, vehemently, profanely, loudly. He is overruled by Phil. Both Wallace and Phil are coming along, and there's nothing we can do about that. We fill thermoses with coffee and grab breakfast to go at the bakery. I think Dalton's hoping that our speedy departure will change Wallace's mind. It doesn't. Within the hour, we're deep in the forest, with the two men and Storm. Dalton takes the lead with the dog, I hang back with Phil and Wallace. That's deliberate, allowing our trackers to work. I chat with Wallace. Phil tries several times to pull Wallace's attention his way, with topics I can't possibly address. American election issues, a stock market roller coaster. But Wallace only answers politely and then steers conversation back to include me. Phil surrenders with a sniff and once-over of me, as if suggesting Wallace is only paying attention to me because I'm female. I get no such vibe from the older man, though. Wallace is just politely keeping conversation on things I can discuss, like the forest itself. When Phil falls back, I warn him to please stay close, but he dawdles just enough that I need to keep shoulder-checking to be sure he's with us. When Wallace realizes both Dalton and Phil are almost out of earshot, he lowers his voice and says,
"I would like to speak to you about something."
He pauses.
"Or perhaps not so much a discussion as a confession."
"Hmm?"
"About Oliver. I know how this looks from your viewpoint. You are a detective. You're supposed to catch people like my stepson and put them in prison. That is what should have happened to Oliver. And yet it did not. Why? Because we're rich. We can afford alternatives. And the alternative I chose resulted in the death of 5 more people."
"Yes." He gives a strained chuckle.
"Not going to sugarcoat that for me, are you?"
"I grew up with money. Not your tax bracket, but my parents had very successful careers, and we enjoyed all the privileges that come with that. So I won't rage about the inherent evil of the upper class. But nor do I agree with anyone using their money and their privilege to keep a serial killer out of prison." We walk in silence for a few minutes. Then he says,
"I told myself I was doing the right thing. The responsible thing. I'm embarrassed to say that now, but it's true. I thought that by incarcerating Oliver, I was saving my country that expense, doing my civic duty by removing him from the population while not charging the taxpayer for our mistakes.
It doesn't work like that."
"Oh, I know. The truth is," he exhales, "I love my wife. I wanted to protect her, not only from a trial, but from ever knowing what Oliver did. As soon as the police started questioning, I hired an investigator. I found evidence and confronted Oliver. When I threatened to turn my evidence over to the police, he confessed. So I whisked him away and told my wife that he was innocent, but we couldn't trust the justice system. I said they'd convict him on the grounds of being a spoiled, rich white boy. But my wife wasn't the only reason I did that. I wanted to avoid the business ramifications of having a serial killer for a stepson. It was a sound business investment. Whatever this costs, it is not nearly the blow my finances would suffer if Oliver was arrested."
Storm barks, and I tense. It's just a quick bark, though, with a response from Dalton. I can see them through the trees around the next curve, and while I can't make out what Dalton's saying, there's no alarm in his voice. Wallace has gone quiet, and I think he's waiting for me to respond. This is, as he said, a confession. A safe one, too. It's not as if I can tell the newspapers what he said. If he wants absolution, he has to look elsewhere. I do, however, credit him for the confession, which is why I just stay quiet.
"I wanted to be clear that I understand my position here."
Wallace continues.
"I am the interloper who brought this on your town. I realize now what I've done, and I'm sorry it took 5 deaths for me to understand that."
Another few steps in silence.
"I really did believe this solution was a valid one. But the hard truth is that anyone who comes into contact with Oliver is at risk. The only true viable solution is one that doesn't put him into contact with anyone, ever."
Execution. That's what he means. And I stiffen, fearing he's hinting that we should resolve this with lethal action. But his gaze is straight ahead, distant. Jail is no longer an option. We both know that. It ceased to be an option as soon as Brady came here. Put him into custody and he'll cut a deal any way he can, including talking about Rockton.
I don't know where to go with this, what to say. So after I glance back for Phil, I change the subject with, "You say it'd be a blow to your personal finances, but Oliver claims your family money comes from his father, from a business he started." Wallace nods.
"Yes, that's his version of history, and it's our fault.
His mother's and mine. We wanted to keep his father alive for him, honor him with a legacy of success." "And the truth?
I worked for Oliver's father. At one time we were partners, but when we formed the business, the money came from his family, so his name went on it. That seemed fair. The problem was that while David was an incredible inventor, he didn't have a lick of business sense. I lacked the clout to overrule him, and at the time of his death, the company was floundering."
"You brought it back." A sharp laugh.
"There was no place to bring it back from. We had investors. David's ideas were incredible. But we'd been scrambling to stay afloat from the start."
"With Oliver's father gone, though, you turned it around."
"Oliver's mother and I did. Together. Yet David's name remains on the company, and we have allowed Oliver the fiction of his brilliant inventor father who launched a billion-dollar corporation. Which led, unfortunately, to Oliver beginning to demand more than a trust fund. When his mother had enough, she showed him the financial records from the year of his father's death. He accused us of forging them. By that point..."
He shrugs.
"By that point, I knew there was no arguing with him. He was never happy, never satisfied. Everyone was conspiring to keep him from his due."
I check for Phil again, and the path behind us is empty. Then I spot him, stopped off the path with his back to us. It's obvious from his stance what he's doing. I turn to give him privacy and call, "Eric, hold up!" I have to shout. He's too far ahead to see on the winding path. Then I say, "Phil, please let us know if you're stopping. The absolute last thing we need..." At a rustle behind me, I turn. But it's not Phil. It's a man holding an old rifle trained on me. Two men armed with knives step out in front of Wallace. Behind them, Phil stands frozen, staring at the men. Their backs are to him, and I tear my gaze away before they spot him. One glance tells me these men are settlers, not hostiles, and I relax at that. I'm cautious, though, gauging the distance to my gun, ready to pull it if that rifle barrel swings out of my way. I open my mouth to speak, then I hear,
"Let them go."
As I turn, Dalton appears at knife point, his hands on the back of his head. Two men and a woman follow at his rear. The woman holds Storm's lead. My gaze drops to the dog.
"Take Storm and our friends there back to Rockton, Casey," Dalton says. "I've got this under control."
If my heart wasn't thudding so hard, I'd laugh. He said the same thing when Jacob had a knife on him. His brother was drugged and ranting and threatening, and Dalton's biggest concern was reassuring me that he could handle it. They'd talk it out. Yeah, just talk it out. No big deal.
"We are not letting your girl go," one of the men says.
"She's my wife," Dalton says. "And if Edwin has one drop of respect for me, he will let her walk away with our guest and the dog. And I will come willingly and answer any questions you have."
Edwin. Questions. The first settlement. The massacre. Oh, shit.
"The girl comes," the man says. "That is what Edwin says. He wishes to speak to the girl."
I swear Wallace snorts softly. He's already realized that, given the choice, everyone prefers to speak to me instead of Dalton. "All right," I say. "Let Eric take our guest and dog home to Rockton. I'll talk to Edwin." Dalton mouths, "Fuck no," his jaw setting in a way I know well. But before he can speak, the man says,
"Edwin will talk to the girl, but he says to bring Steve's boy. That was the order. Do not let him leave. If he tries,"
he looks at Dalton,
"shoot him."
Chapter 46. We walked to the first settlement. They were willing to let Wallace go, but he refused.
"I don't know my way back," he said.
"Just follow," I began.
"Somehow it seems safer to stay with you two. I've heard quite enough about this forest."
As for Phil, he's gone. Fled without ever being spotted. I try to talk to the settlers. Diffuse this situation. But they have been warned not to speak to us, and they are already wary. So I fall to silence, walking beside Dalton, armed settlers in front and behind. We're nearing the first settlement when the men in front of us turn and point their guns.
"Hands behind your back,"
one says, taking out a length of rope.
"Fuck no,"
Dalton says. The woman steps forward.
"Get your hands behind your back, boy, or we'll put a bullet through your damn skull."
Dalton wheels on her.
"Excuse me?" "Enough,"
one of the men turns to Dalton.
"We are not letting you walk into our village after what happened. You will be disarmed. You will have your hands bound. People are angry. If we bring you in like guests, there will be trouble."
Dalton grumbles, but puts his hands behind his back and then lets them disarm us. Wallace silently follows our lead. The woman glowers at Dalton's grumblings.
"You're lucky we don't shoot you and drag your bodies through the settlement."
"What the hell?"
Dalton says. She steps up to him. "Albie, Nancy, Douglas." "The people who died," I say. "Yes, we take full responsibility for letting their killer escape."
"Escape? What do you expect?"
one of the guys says.
"They're going to blame this on someone else."
"No," I say carefully. "We acknowledge the killer was one of ours."
"So now you're blaming some innocent person from Rockton?" the woman says.
"Was that your plan? Bring us a body and say, there's your killer?" "Or is it him?"
the man turns to Wallace.
"Are you forcing this old man to take the fall?"
"What the hell are you talking about?"
Dalton says. The woman steps right in front of him and spits up in his face. I move between them fast. "We don't know what's happening here."
"Harper told us who killed our people," the woman said.
"Your husband. She saw it and she barely escaped with her life." Chapter 47. We cannot even begin to speculate on what's happened here, which doesn't keep Dalton from demanding answers. But our captors are not talking. We enter the village at gunpoint. The first settlement is composed of about 10 cabins, spread over a couple of acres. As people emerge from homes, the palpable weight of their rage pulses through the air. If I had any idea what they thought we'd done, I'd have fought our captors. Allowing a dangerous Rockton resident to escape was one thing. We could have handled that, though. Made promises. Made apologies. Made concessions. Now? I glance at Dalton. His face is taut, gaze straight ahead, jaw set as if he's outraged. But the vein throbbing in his neck tells me he is afraid.
"In here,"
one of our captors prods Dalton toward a dilapidated building. When I see Harper, I try to catch her eye, not accusing, but confused, concerned. I gesture that I would like to speak to her, but she's pretending not to see me. She circles to a man behind us and says something. He shakes his head. She gestures my way, and I think it's at me, but then I realize she's pointing at Storm. The man shakes his head and reaches to squeeze her thin shoulder, but she throws him off and stomps away. Dalton's captor prods him again.
"Yeah, no,"
he says.
"I'll wait here for Edwin."
"You aren't talking to Edwin,"
the man nods at me.
"She is." "Fine, then I'll sit my ass down right here and wait."
The man points at the building.
"You will wait there. She will wait at Edwin's."
Dalton opens his mouth, but I shake my head. He hesitates, and I know this makes him nervous. It makes me nervous, too. But we cannot give them any excuse for using those weapons to force us to obey. Dalton stalks off toward the building, muttering the whole way. our captors prod Wallace to follow Dalton. I let them take me to Edwin's place. They open the door, and I walk in as calmly as I can, as if this is an obvious misunderstanding that I know will be cleared up. Edwin isn't there. I turn to ask where he is, but they've shut the door behind me. I take a deep breath and sit on the floor. Storm lowers herself beside me, leaning in hard, panting with nervous tension. I pat her and tell her it will be okay. It will all be okay. I hope it will be okay. I've been there about 10 minutes when I hear a noise in the next room. The door swings open and Harper stands there, an open window behind her, a knife in her hand. "Put that down," I say.
"I just came here to talk."
"Good. Then you don't need a knife." She shakes her head. I ask her one more time. Then I take it. She doesn't see that coming. She tries to slash, but I already have her by the forearm. I squeeze just tight enough to hold her steady. Then I pluck the knife from her hand. When I release her, she swings at me. I grab her arm, pin it behind her back, march her to the open window, and drop the knife through it. When I let her go, she backs off, rubbing her wrist.
"That hurt,"
she says, and there's genuine shock in her voice.
"You attacked, I defended."
She eyes me as if this calm response isn't what she expects.
"It was my knife. I was defending myself."
"One shot will bring the guard to your aid. I only put your knife outside. I didn't keep it." She's still eyeing me. She says again,
"That hurt."
And there's a tremor of outrage, as if I should be ashamed of myself hurting a kid. But like she said the other day, she is not a child. Not out here. "What's going on?" I say. I'm waiting for the look of worry, of guilt. The one that says they've made her blame us. Someone has forced her to make a false statement. Someone she respects. Someone she fears. I'm waiting for her to apologize. To say she had no choice. When she says,
"I told the truth,"
my heart sinks. But I am not surprised.
"The truth?"
I say.
"Eric killed them. I was there."
I could blame post-traumatic stress, confusion, even fear. Instead, I say,
"Why?"
"Why what?" Now I'm the one eyeing her, sizing her up. There's no point in Harper coming here to talk.
"What do you want?"
I say. I follow her gaze to Storm.
"No."
"Yes. She's town property."
"She's yours," Harper says. "I heard Eric say that he got her for you."
"Are you sure?" Her face scrunches up.
"That he got her for you?"
"No, that you overheard it." "When? As you were running for your life? After Eric killed 3 of your people?"
"I want her."
She says it as if this is a simple matter. As if she is indeed a child. One too young to have realized that a wish is not a command or an obligation. But I'm not sure it is childlike to her. Out here, it's a very normal thing. At least for some of the settlers and probably all of the hostels.
"I want this thing. You have it, so I will take it from you."
I remember the young man, Albie, checking out our horses, suggesting where we might camp, and Dalton being sure not to camp there.
"You have this thing that I want, and I will take it from you, and that's nothing personal. It's just the way it is."
Harper steps toward Storm, who leans against me, whining. The girl looks at me.
"Tell Eric that you're giving me the dog, and I'll tell Edwin I made a mistake."
"Little late for that, isn't it?" I say.
"What?
How exactly do you tell him you made a mistake? Say that you hallucinated Eric murdering your people? Or that the event was so traumatic you forgot what happened and made something up? How will that make you seem?" I see her mental gears whirring madly as she looks for the trap here. There must be a trap. Why else would I ever advise her not to rescind her story?
"You want a new husband,"
she says. "What?" She nods, satisfied. You have met someone new in your town, and you want him. Or you never wanted Eric, but he is the leader, and you cannot say no to the leader. Yes, I say. He is the leader, my boss. But if he's gone, you want his job. As she says that, I get a glimpse into the woman behind the girl's mask. When she speculates I simply want a new lover, she is dismissive. Now, as I claim it is ambition, respect flashes in her eyes. Can you help me? I say. For the dog? I nod. For the dog. What do I need to do? Just stick to your story. Exactly to it. Can you do that? She nods. Tell me everything you told Edwin. Chapter 48. You can learn so much about a person by how they react to others. In the forest, my view of Harper was formed almost entirely by how she responded to Storm. I love my dog, and Harper found her fascinating, and that made me happy. It made me open up to her, engage her, see her as more than just some settler kid. I never suspected there was darkness in her. I don't believe she actually realizes what she's done. She is incapable of realizing it. She wants Storm. I have Storm. Therefore, she must get her from me. And if Dalton is endangered by her actions, well, he's a stranger, a meaningless bit player in her life drama. And so was I, until I admitted that I'd like my lover out of the picture so I can take his job. With that, I became someone interesting to her. In her strengths, she also shows me her weaknesses. After Harper leaves, I wait for Edwin to finally show up. He'll bring Harper with him, and I'm prepared for that. The door opens, and my guard walks in.
Edwin is ready for you,
he says. Good. I'm here. The man shakes his head.
He is waiting out here.
I tell myself this will still work. Then I step outside, and Storm starts whining, and I look over to see Dalton being led, bound and gagged, across the village. Wallace follows, bound but not gagged, and he's glancing about, taking everything in, and I don't think he really understands what's at stake here. How can he? He doesn't come from a world where strangers can grab you in the forest, accuse you of murder, and string you up from the nearest tree. To him, this is just an interesting cultural study, a blustering show of force, all sound and fury, signifying nothing. Because there's no way these people would actually hurt us. Dalton is being Dalton. Chin up, shoulders squared. He's not worried. Nope, not worried at all. When he sees me, the facade cracks, but only for me. Am I okay? He can see I am, and he nods.
Don't worry, Casey. I may be gagged and bound, but I have everything under control.
I could shake my head at that, but he's really just saying that he trusts me to have a plan. Trusts that I will get us out of this. No pressure. We are all led to the village square, where the village waits. I skim count 30 heads, all adults. Edwin stands at the front. Someone has brought him a chair, but he's ignoring it. He's a small man, not much bigger than me, wizened by age. The guard starts leading Storm away, and she digs in her nails, growling. She knows Harper, I say. Let Harper hold her. The girl takes Storm's lead. I turn to Edwin.
What do you want? Due process. This is a trial. A murder trial.
And you are the judge. No lawyers, I'm guessing.
I was one,
he says. And one lawyer is quite enough. He doesn't quite smile, but the glimmer in his eyes awards me a point for that. I continue. I'm presuming, though, that if you've gagged Eric, I'm acting as his lawyer. Witness and counsel.
Correct.
As a former lawyer, sir, you'll recognize the predicament I'm in here, I say. All I know is that Eric has been accused of killing your people. I don't know what Harper told you, I don't know what you might have found at the scene. There's been no discovery, no formal laying of charges. So I'll skip straight to the biggest missing piece. Motivation. Why did Eric do this? Harper tenses, but I nod for her to trust me. Edwin waves the question off.
As you well know, Detective, motivation isn't important. Fact is what matters.
Yes, motivation gets in the way of an investigation. It clouds fact. But this is a trial. Unless Eric has confessed, we need motive.
We have an eyewitness.
I give him a look. Just a look. He grants me another point. Juries love eyewitnesses, but a lawyer knows how unreliable they are. Fine, I say. Set motive aside for now. What is the evidence beyond your witness? You returned to the scene to collect your dead, I presume.
Our people did.
And you saw how they died? Albie killed at his guard post, the older man in his sleeping blankets, Harper's grandmother running for her life. A grumble runs through the crowd. This reminder does not please them. What evidence do you have that Eric did this? I ask.
He fled the scene, which means we can hardly search his belongings for bloody clothes or a weapon.
What you need, then, is a second eyewitness. I glance at Harper. Her face is glowing now. She sees victory. I will be that witness for her. I believe I have your motivation, I say. And then I switch to Mandarin with, keep your eyes on me, please, sir. His brows lift, but he does as I ask. I nod discreetly to Harper, who is fairly quivering with anticipation. I do not dare implicate my lover when he stands right there, so I am using another language to do it. A language I share with her leader. Motivation, I say to Edwin. I speak slowly, carefully. My Mandarin is rusty and probably the equivalent of a 4-year-old's. You know Eric doesn't have one. You can't even think of one. His mouth opens. I continue, while sneaking looks at Dalton. Worried looks. Maybe guilty looks. For Harper's benefit. Dalton doesn't even frown. He trusts me. But I have a motivation for you, I say. A motivation for Harper to lie. That is right in front of your eyes. I have something that she wants.
The dog?
That's... He doesn't finish. I have something she wants, I say. He shakes his head.
Then she would know you're telling me the truth now. She would be arguing.
Not if I've convinced her I want Eric's job, and that she can have the dog if she sticks to her story.
What happened out there?
I tell him. When I finish, I say, which story makes logical sense? Edwin says, in English,
so you were tasked with imprisoning a killer. You failed to do that, and we suffered. Is that your story, Detective?
Oh, shit. I haven't fixed anything. Edwin never believed Dalton did it. This was all for show. We haven't dodged a bullet. We just stepped back into the path of the one that's been coming at us since we fled the massacre. Yes, I say. We accept responsibility.
You did not. You walked away. You failed to show the basic respect due my people.
Yeah,
says a muffled voice. I look to see Dalton has managed to get the gag down just enough to talk over it. He twists, and it drops further, and he shakes it off, saying,
yeah, I did. That was my choice, because I knew there was no way in hell we'd come in here, confess to our mistake, and you'd let us walk away. And there was no way in hell I was putting up with your bullshit while I've got a killer out there.
My bullshit?
Edwin's voice lowers, heavy with warning.
Yes, and don't give me that tone. You're in charge here. I'm in charge in Rockton. We're equals, which means you should have shown me the basic respect of marching me in here for a private audience, not tying me up, gagging me, and talking to my detective instead. You know why I didn't come here right away. I wish I could have. Would have saved us all a shitload of grief. But I couldn't. And this is all fucking theatrics, so cut the bullshit and let me get on with my job.
I think perhaps we should put that gag back on.
Sure. Dalton meets his gaze. Go ahead and try.